Joining us on the hotline right now, covering MMA and combat sports for CBS, he's Brian Campbell. What's going on, Brian?
No, fired up is all hell. What else would I be right now? We got big fights coming up. It's a good time to be alive.
Big fights. You know, we always like big fights. And we had a couple of pretty good fights this weekend. One of them, you know, this was a tough one for me to swallow because I've always been a firm believer in if you're going to take the belt off the champ, you got to beat him. Like, it can't be a questionable. Like, you got to beat him. Henry Cejudo took the belt off the champ. Demetrius Johnson, he's held that belt for how many years? You know, he's been, it's like 6 years that he's held that belt, and he loses via split decision. Was it the right call?
No, it wasn't the right call. And the problem with the idea of, you know, to beat the champion, you got to do just that. You got to beat him is obviously the MMA is judged on a round-by-round basis. But I think even on a round-by-round basis, I had a lot of trouble giving three of those rounds to Henry Cejudo. You know, you give him credit for the two-year evolution he's made since coming into the sport and sort of getting rushed into that first title opportunity when he was stopped in the first round 2 years ago against Johnson. But look, you know, he landed almost 100 less strikes, and while he was successful, particularly in the end of that third and fifth round, in taking Johnson down and holding him on the ground, it wasn't like he cut Johnson. It wasn't like he put him in situations of danger. This was a bout where we find out after Johnson had injuries, and maybe he wasn't the same Mighty Mouse, but he landed the cleaner strikes. He was more dynamic, and I think, if anything, the only thing that held Johnson back was he also didn't hurt Cejudo either. So when you aren't as demonstrative in how you control and win rounds, it does leave it open a little bit more to interpretation. But for two of the three judges to watch that and give three rounds to Cejudo, it felt like a little bit of a stretch.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that stat about number of strikes landed?
You know, Johnson landed upwards of almost 100 more strikes in the entire fight. And, I mean, you know, that's what he did. He switched stances. He darted in and out. He was the one landing clean shots. You can't judge a fight by someone's face. But after the fight, Cejudo had a very blotched and swollen face. Johnson looked like he wasn't touched. So I think the best thing Johnson did, along with landing clean shots, was he also kept himself out of big-time danger. Even when he was taken down, most of those takedowns he worked back to his feet instantly, and for the most part, he was never in a position where he can get hit with more than one punch at a time. He fought, technically, a brilliant fight. He just didn't have those type of big moments per round that would give the judges no doubt. It was tough to see such an impressive long streak end on sort of a close fight like that, but obviously you take nothing away from the drama. That was a fun fight. It just wasn't demonstrative either way.
See, and I thought only Manny Pacquiao could lose a fight where he landed 100 more punches than his opponent. Well, I'm with you. I find that tough, especially a guy who's been a champion as long as Johnson's been a champion, that if you're splitting hairs about which way to go, I got a hard time taking a belt off a guy for splitting hairs. This fight, there was no splitting hairs. TJ Dillashaw, TKO on Cody Brabrandt, first round. You know, the last time it was the second round, TJ's got a history of, you know, being better in rematches. This one didn't last real long.
No, not at all. And, I mean, this is a wake-up call for people out there. When I say people, I mean critics, fans, even UFC brass. TJ Dillashaw is really, really, really good. If he's not worse than the second pound-for-pound fighter in the world right now, then maybe you should get your head examined. He's gone out there and really done this to almost every big name he's fought. I know he lost a questionable decision to Rafael Assuncao that he ran back and dominated, and I know he lost a very, very close and questionable decision to Dominic Cruz 3 years ago when he lost his title and never got the immediate rematch like Cody Garbrandt did. So look, maybe he's not the prototype fighter that you can build a promotion around, but I felt like he's been very underserved by the UFC in terms of how he's been marketed. Maybe he's not a big-time trash talker, but you saw what he can do in there on Saturday night. He's got that perfect combination of speed, of power, and dynamic movement. He's almost never at rest. We know he can wrestle. We know he can strike. There's nothing else this guy has to do besides just keep going out of there and knocking people out. When you now realize he's twice stopped Cody Garbrandt, twice stopped Henan Barao, I thought he'd beat Dominic Cruz. The idea of thinking of him as possibly either already the best bantamweight in MMA history or certainly on his way there is really not that too far of a leap. This guy really is that good. I thought it was great that he was able to work his way back into a title shot and then to put in forth these type of performances. It's like, let's collectively all join hands, hands across America, and say, TJ, you're good. You are the guy right now. You are that guy. Let's give him your due.
Talking with Brian Campbell, covers combat sports for CBS Sports, with us on the hotline. And, Brian, as we look ahead to UFC 228, we're gonna get a couple of high end women's fights. Valentina Shevchenko and Nico Montano. I don't know a whole lot about Montano. Maybe you can kind of fill us in. Is she legitimately in Valentina's league?
Absolutely not. If you look at the betting odds, this is the largest, a champion being an underdog. This is the widest we've ever seen in UFC title history. Shevchenko coming in as a monster favorite, and rightfully so. You just said, I don't really know a lot about Nico Montano. You know what? Nobody does. And that's not to be rude or funny. This was another knee-jerk decision by the UFC to create a division where, to be honest, it didn't have a depth of fighters that were ready to fill this. And then on top of that, to sort of rush that title situation when Montano was forced to face an opponent on last-minute notice. She defeated veteran Roxanne Modafferi. It certainly wasn't a high-profile fight or performance. The good news could be that Shevchenko is a quality top-five female pound-for-pound fighter that, if she wins this title, we could see a good reign in our future. This is a credible fighter who it's good to see her get this opportunity after two very close losses to bantamweight champion Amanda Nunes. But I think when you look at what's happening in this new division 125 and what's been happening the last 2 years at 145, another UFC women's division that they have created, and there's no fighters in there. I want anybody out there listening, if you have a few extra minutes, go on UFC.com, click on rankings. You'll see the top 10 for every division. There's one division you won't see, UFC Women's Featherweight. We're 2 years in. There's still no other fighters besides Chris Cyborg. I think a lot of these little knee-jerk reactions of late, they annoy a lot of fans, and it catches up after a while. But like I said, if Shevchenko wins, that's good business moving forward.
All right, Chris, Conor McGregor's going to get back in the cage finally. I guess he's, you do a lot of crazy stuff. You wind up in court, and then you get a title shot against Khabib. And this fight's going to happen in 2 months. Is that enough time for Conor to get ready, considering he's kind of been distracted with a whole bunch of other stuff?
There's certainly elements to be concerned about if you're a big Conor fan, not just the physical toll of that long of a layoff when you talk about things like cage rust. But yes, like you said, this is a short turnaround. It's certainly a short turnaround from a promotion standpoint. But I think in Conor's favor, in defense of this, is he has seemingly been active the last 2 years, been in great shape, constantly posting photos and videos of himself in the gym. We also, of course, saw him come back for that Floyd Mayweather boxing fight, which had to at least keep him fresh. But this is such a weird scenario, this fight, because I'm overwhelmingly fired up and excited like everybody else. And yes, this has potential to break the UFC's and MMA's pay-per-view record as a whole. This could be a 2 million buy pay-per-view. But before we get fired up and break down this 50-50 matchup and why the grudge match and the pro wrestling angle of it is so great, it's that little moral elephant in the room that says, like you just made the joke, you're going to reward this guy for committing a felony, injuring other UFC fighters, actually affecting the UFC 223 card, where they were lucky that the main event participants weren't injured or even killed, as extreme as that sounds. And now Conor's getting rewarded with a giant money pay-per-view. Brock Lesnar's getting rewarded for a steroid test with a title shot. Darren Till comes in 4 pounds overweight and wins a disputed fight, and now he's getting a title shot. A lot of questionable decisions at the top. I know no one's going to care. We're all going to be there October 6th on pay-per-view or cage side in Las Vegas, and it may just end up being one of the greatest fights of all time because on paper, yes, it's really that good. But hey, UFC, we see you. This smells fishy. Can you at least address this? Can you at least come forward and claim ownership and say, yes, there's special treatment for special fighters? Because if it was anybody else named than Conor McGregor that put a dolly through the window and put glass in some people's bodies, they would never fight again. Just ask Paul Daly about that.
Yeah. It's funny because it's Conor McGregor because of the massive following he has. And you've got people who want to watch Conor because they love Conor. And then you've got people who want to watch Conor because they hate Conor.
It's perfectly polarizing. It's the Floyd Mayweather playbook. It's great.
All right, let's we pop ahead to 2:30, and you've got Dustin Poirier and Nate Diaz. First of all, is this fight actually going to happen, or is something going to happen with Nate Diaz where he's not going to fight?
You know, Nate Diaz's reaction to that Conor announcement, when it was obviously a surprise to him in L.A. at that UFC news conference when the video played, he walked out. We all saw the social media videos afterwards of him swearing, calling out the UFC, says he's not going to fight. Dana White didn't seem too worried in all the interviews he did after that. And I think in the end, hopefully Nate has the right people in his corner who say, look, you haven't fought in more than 2 years. This is a big opportunity. You're probably getting paid pretty well. You probably need the money at this point after 2.5 years. And guess what? If you win this fight, you're probably going to fight for the title, and it may be against Conor McGregor. So this really is a best-case scenario for Nate in terms of a comeback. I'm not sure exactly what his beef is. Is it that Conor McGregor is trumping him? Is it that he didn't get a chance to face him when that's the fight he wanted all along? Or does it have more to do with pay-per-view points and not being on that card? We're not really sure. But what UFC has established in just a couple years now is that when they put on these shows at MSG in New York, they're a big deal. That's the biggest card of the year, more or less. I hope Nate Diaz bites down and goes into that fight, because this is a big one. It's an important one. It's a tough one. And like Dustin Poirier said himself at the press conference, this could be three of the greatest rounds we've ever seen in the UFC. There's that much potential for fireworks.
You know, and he's getting the third-ranked fighter in the division. You know, Poirier is that's not a chump. That's a big-time fighter. And, yeah, like you said, you beat this guy who's number three. You might be fighting for the belt next.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and it stinks, because I do sort of understand Diaz's larger frustration. And it's this point, I think he's the least promoted fighter in all of UFC. You heard the crowd pop at that press conference when he walked out late. It was like a cult hero walking in. If only Dana White and UFC could understand that better, or deal with Nate better, and really get out of him what they needed. You know what they needed the last 2 years? Superstars that moved the needle while Conor and Rousey and John Jones were away. Nate Diaz, in my mind, could have been that guy if only they can really work out their differences and treat him like a superstar, not treat him like a nuisance, because it's rare that in a non-pro wrestling scripted world, somebody can get this much of a babyface following when he's kind of acts like a bad dude at times. I mean, he's an anti-hero, and he's over, so to speak. Push this guy to the gills.
Chris, we got about a minute. Brian, we got about a minute left here, and I just want to ask you real quick. Right after that, there's a fight night, November 10th. Frankie Edgar and the Korean Zombie. Now, I haven't seen Korean Zombie fight a lot. I did see his last fight. But the injuries, the military time, the mandatory service for South Korea, I haven't seen him in the cage much. And he's going to go up against Frankie Edgar, who is one of the greatest ever at 145. What do you expect from that fight?
You know, it's one of those interesting fights, because not only does it scream violence and action and take your phone off the hook, tell your friends to come over, it's one of those fights. We're going to see something special here. Yes, the inactivity for Korean Zombie, but at the same time, you know, Frankie Edgar may be going down that other side of the hill now. Certainly he's not in his prime anymore, but the way that he lost to Ortega in that fight, when it's over for these guys, especially guys in their mid to late 30s who have held on and kept it together and stayed a title contender, when it's gone, it's gone. And one of these days it's going to be gone for Frankie Edgar, unfortunately, for a guy we love and respect. Could it be in this fight? Could this be a secret, sneaky trap fight for him? Or is Korean Zombie the perfect opponent that's just going to get right into a brawl and he can take him out? I'm not really sure. Maybe it'll be in the middle and it'll be a fight of the year. Either way, we got to see it. We got to be there. And for a 25th anniversary card that doesn't seem like they're loading it up with big fights, this is at least a fun fight. And we all, of course, remember that night 25 years ago in Denver when it first started, and how much the sport has changed. This feels like kind of a throwback fight into the old school violence to remember what it used to be like.
Brian Campbell covers MMA for CBS Sports. You can follow him on Twitter at @bcampbellcbs. He also hosts the In This Corner podcast, so check that out too, at @bcampbellcbs. Brian, really appreciate your time today. Great stuff. Let's have you back on soon.
Anytime. Great talking to you.
All right. Brian Campbell, CBS, with us on the hotline.